Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
"2,500 years ago, there lived a man by the name of Lao Tzu. Some years later, after his death, it is said that his disciple, Chuang Tzu, carried on his teaching. Chuang Tzu has been called the genius of the absurd. He tells odd little stories. I mean, they're very peculiar sometimes, like Fret and Fuss that lived on Mount something or another. You know, it's and about the yeah, Fret and Fuss went one time to see chaos. And chaos was so good to them that they decided to help him. And they noticed that chaos didn't have any apertures. So every day they came and drilled a hole. And on the seventh day, chaos disappeared. Really? It's terrific. Genius of the absurd. He is really terrific. Anyway, we have a story from his repertoire this morning. Duke Huan of Qi was first in his dynasty. Sat under a canopy reading his philosophy. Tian, the wheelwright, was out in the yard making a wheel. Tian laid aside his hammer and chisel. He climbed the steps and said to this Duke Huan, "May I ask you, Lord, what is this you are reading?" And the Duke answered, "The experts, the authorities." And Tian asked, "Dead or alive?" Oh, and the Duke said, "Oh, dead a long time." Then said the wheelwright, "You are reading only the dirt that they left behind." And the Duke looked at him and said, "Well, what do you know about it? You're only a wheelwright. You had better give me a good explanation or else you must die, you know, off with your head." And the wheelwright said, "Let us look at the affair from my point of view. When I make wheels, if I go easy, they fall apart. If I am too rough, they do not fit. But if I am neither too easy nor too violent, they turn out right. The work is what I want it to be." You cannot put this into words. You just have to know how it is. I cannot even tell my own son exactly how it is done, and my son cannot learn it from me. So here I am, 70 years old, still making wheels. The men of old took all they really knew with them to the grave. And so, Lord, what you are reading there is only dirt they left behind. On a backcountry road one day, A motorist going along suddenly had trouble with his engine. So he stopped the car by the side of the road, and he opened the hood, and he looked inside. And he's looking inside, and suddenly he hears this voice saying, "If you ask me, I can tell you what the trouble is." And surprised, he looks around, because he thought, you know, there was nobody else there. It was a deserted country road. And he looked around, and no, there was nobody there. There was just a horse, you know, standing in the yard nearby. And he looked around again, and he knew he'd heard this voice. And here's nothing but this old horse, and he became frightened, so down the road he went. No? And after 20 minutes of running, he reached a filling station. And when he caught his breath, why, he told the attendant at the station what had happened. There was nobody there, nothing but a horse, and I know I heard a voice. And the service station attendant then asked, by any chance, was the horse black? You know, was he swaybacked? Was he bow-legged? Yeah, that's him. Well, don't mind him. He's just an old philosopher, dead long ago, but haunting the place, you know. Out of habit, you know, he goes on looking for people to question and to question him. He's not a horse, really. He's just using a horse's body, you know. So just don't mind him. Yeah. But there are people, you know, the world over who would flock to hear a horse talk. You know, how entrancing that would be to go and hear a horse talk. Philosophy, yet answering deep questions, answering easy questions, even how to fix an engine, even though when he was alive there weren't any engines around. Do you ever do anything like this to yourself? Are old philosophies still managing you? Are old experiences governing the new so you can't realize fully what the new experience is? So the past haunts you. Yeah. We do some very queer things as human beings. When the Buddha was alive, there were many people that rejected him. After all, he was changing the old patterns. I mean, here in India, they'd had this pattern, this tradition, for centuries, and here comes this man who says, you know, don't look for the self, look for the no self. There is no self as such. Yeah. Myself against yourself. Yeah. So a lot of people rejected him. And of course, in the final analysis, India rejected his whole teaching, because there is very little Buddhism in India today, where it was born. But Buddha dead, no longer any bones, and no longer any blood, and no longer any flesh, and so he becomes a person that never becomes ill. Well, he wasn't, but he's never hungry. He can do anything now. He can walk on the water, and he can sit in the sky. So the image that people have become something entirely different, because we reach higher and higher and higher abstractions until at last we come to some imagined paradise. Alive, Jesus was crucified, and dead, he is worshipped. Yeah. Death destroys the body, and it destroys then this link. There's a kind of a link is broken, so that now we can have a spiritual image that is bloodless and boneless and really superphysical. Now, whatever you want to imagine about that person, you can. You can imagine anything you want. Any quality you can project on that image. It's a little difficult to do this with a living person. Because the reality is present. And more than likely, that person will destroy your projection. do it all the time, don't they? Always such a good person. Oh, look what you did. Huh? Or, you know, I don't like that person. Oh, look what he did, how kind. Huh? Destroying projections all the time. Because a living person is not ready to become a prisoner of your ideas. No. But dead, what can he do? Huh? See? Now you have become the superiority. Huh? You have become the authority. You have now got the upper hand. And yet, a man like Buddha alive can help us. There is that in such a person. And they use the word imbibe. You can imbibe of something. You can take something into your mind. You can take something into your soul. Yes. And that something that you take is of that spirit. There is something to be communicated. But when he's dead, that's impossible. Because what that person, let us say the Buddha, and there have been many since the Buddha, all the patriarchs, you know, what they had to give was not just words. But words, you know, they create a contact. And if one is very receptive, you know, there is something in the word or between the words. There is a frequency, let us call it. Huh? There is something that can be imbibed. We can drink it in and it can become a living experience. And now and then we read something. And as we say the words to ourselves, reading, the words touch something within us. And then maybe rises something a teacher once said to us. Somebody had planted a seed in the psyche, And now comes this response to it. And it's a living experience. You know, it's quite impossible to teach somebody to swim with words. It's experience teaches. Experience shows. It teaches us and it shows us a way, always a new way. It opens. So don't let the past just over the thing and put it into a little box. Let the experience remain as it came. Because, you know, spirituality is a little bit like swimming. You can't say it. You can talk about it all day long, but you don't say it. You can describe, but to know it, you have to get wet. Yeah. And when it happens, you know, it is an alive experience. Now, you have a Bible. Most of you have a Bible. And you read it now and then. Maybe not. But you can become a great scholar of the Bible. You know, you can think about it, and you can spin around with it, you know, and you can even create a theology of your own. Well, most of us do. What you believe is what you have gathered all around. Yeah. I mean, you may listen to me, but what you believe is not exactly what I believe. That would be impossible. Right? So most of us have a theology of our own. Yeah. But in all of this reading of the Bible, presence of the man that inspired the scripture, be it Jesus or be it Buddha, is not present in this spinning and weaving. If you will really look at the theology that you spin and weave, this is the center of it, me. So when you look, when you read the scripture, your Bibles, remember it is a mirror. And you will see your own face in it. You can read anything into it that you like, and you usually do. And there is no Jesus to say, no, that was not my meaning. You know that Freud, in the last year of his life, he gathered his disciples around him. And one day, about 20 of them were having lunch. Freud sitting there. And they began to discuss a particular point that Freud had discovered and what he had meant by this. And they became so absorbed in this discussion that they even forgot that Freud was present. And here they are, 20 of them, arguing with each other, contradicting each other, one theory and 20 interpretations. And it got to the point, finally, where Freud hammered on the table, and he said, one thing, please, I'm still alive. You can ask me what I mean. And listening to you, I can see what's going to happen when I'm dead. See, and this is how the many sects and the many creeds come about. Because Jesus now, he was a very simple man. He was the son of a carpenter. And he was a carpenter. He was not a man of a great many words. He was a man of experience. He talked simply, in little stories, in little anecdotes and parables. And look what's come out of it. It's a mountain. All the discussion and all the arguing, so much so that in some places, Jesus is forgotten. And then in the Eastern traditions, there is the Bhagavad Gita. Shankaracharya says it is a message of renunciation. And Tilak says, no, it's a message of action. And Ramanuja says, well, it's a message of devotion. Well, all three are correct about the Gita. There's no need to argue. Whatever you want, you're going to find in it. What we read and what we hear somehow becomes an interpretation of our state of consciousness. That's something I don't think you should forget. What do you think? What you do, that's your state of consciousness. So what is this consciousness with which you are aware of this world? We can escape from all kinds of things. You can escape from God. You can escape from Buddha. You can escape from Jesus. You can escape from Krishna. And at the same time you're trying to escape, you're carrying a Bible or a Bhagavad Gita in your pocket or in our heads. And you keep the book in your pocket. The Bible belongs to you. You can own the Bible. You say, this is mine. But you cannot own Jesus. You have to be possessed by him. Hmm? The nirvana that the Buddha spoke of, you know, is not this outer world which we have projected on everything. There is nothing here that corresponds to it. And when Jesus talked about the kingdom of God, it's not of this objective world. Now we know that, huh? Sure. Religion is subjective. It's within us. And so the significance of what is said is here. Yeah. And now a man like Buddha, he taught for 49 years. He was a craftsman. You know, they say, making gods out of men. Yeah. And like a sculpture, you know, hammering on stone, you know, throwing away all that is non-essential. And by, this image is discovered. The image was there before the artist started with a hammer and chisel. It was there, but so was the non-essential. And that has to be chiseled and hammered away so that the essential can rise all by itself. When we cut away at this non-essential, you know, then this magnificence rises, huh? And what sometimes is called the other world penetrates into this one. It's not that something new has come into this world. It's simply a transformation of seeing and hearing and tasting and smelling. So we need to observe always ourselves. Always ourselves, so we can separate the non-essential from the essential. To separate the possessor from the possession, if you want. And slowly, 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 it comes about. Because meditation is a skill. When someone like the Buddha speaks, you know, he is not the speaker. When the Buddha moves, he is not the walker. You know, as Rinzai so aptly put it way back there in the 9th century, huh? The Buddha was never born, and he never taught. But when he puts his hand on your head, Tao is present. And this very factor can cause this shift in consciousness. If you're receptive, if you will respond. So now, if you can't learn from a living one, how are you going to learn from a dead one? Meditation. The greatest skill in the world to make a god out of a man or a woman. And you know our scriptures do say, ye are gods. To be able to change your mind, to be able to flex around in the mind, as nature changes all the time, huh? To be able to drop this ego, this possessor, and then to allow this ultimate to happen. So Chuang Tzu said, and this little anecdote now, Duke Huan of Qi, first in his dynasty, sat under his canopy reading his philosophy. And Fien the wheelwright was out in the yard making a wheel. Fien laid aside his hammer and his chisel, and he climbed the steps, and he said to Duke Huan, "May I ask you, Lord, what is it that you are reading?" And the Duke said, "The experts, the authorities." And Fien asked, "Dead or living?" Now, experts and authorities we have all around us. Just ask them. We have so many that sometimes it's difficult for us to choose. And we do mill around because we say to ourselves, you know, I am a rational person and I cannot believe so easily. And I have all these doubts. And the first thing I have to do is satisfy all my doubts. Well, that takes time, doesn't it? Takes a whole lifetime. Yeah. Because is doubt ever satisfied? So, you know, it is said that we stand on a shore of ignorance, and what we want to do is cross over to the other shore of wisdom, and here is this sometimes spoken of an abyss between, or the ocean between. So to get from this shore to that shore, you know, jump! You know, let the consciousness shift. And jump with the doubt. You lose it. If you're going to wait until all the doubt subsides, then the time will never come for you to take the jump. Because doubt, you know, is a self-perpetuating process. You know, one doubt creates another, and then another, and then another, and then another. Now, some of you, when you first began to sit, you know, there was this wavering. Hardly anyone ever begins to sit without this wavering, you know, or am I going to do this right thing and this thing right? And all the questions, you know, and all the doubts about the process itself, about oneself, you know. Well, hardly anyone ever starts with a total heart. One starts with doubt. And there are times when doubt is extremely important. You know, the Zennists say there is the great doubt. That's important. But there are times, too, when doubt should be set aside and saying to oneself, how about paying attention to some trust? That's here too. You have to trust even when you have doubt. Ego will continue to say, and will always say, oh, don't do that. Don't let go. You will be lost if you let go. Well, where are you now? Yeah. You know, it's like some people, they enjoy driving. And they enjoy driving very fast. And they just enjoy driving. You know, they drive from here to Los Angeles, and then they drive from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and they drive from San Francisco to Sacramento, just to drive. Or maybe drive from here to New York, and oh, I made it in 36 hours. You know, just to drive. You know. And like the man who was driving this doctor to a little remote village, and he was going very fast, great speed along the highway. And they were supposed to reach this village by early afternoon, and evening is approaching, and they're driving very fast. So the doctor, you know, He finally, it's a hole of a map. And it says to this man, after perusing it a little, "It seems that we have taken the wrong route." And the driver answers, "Oh, don't bother about a map. We're enjoying the ride." You know, some people are like this. They're simply going fast. And when you're going that fast, who cares whether you arrive or not? Just so you can go fast. Just keep moving. It is not movement that leads, it's direction. It's not by running that you reach your destiny. Maybe you're just running in a circle. Just boom. So look at the direction. What have you got to lose? Nothing, huh? Then why are you afraid? Afraid of losing nothing? People say it's very difficult to surrender. Well, you know, we could also ask them, what have you got to surrender? Yeah. What have they got to renounce? What about this expertise that they think they're going to surrender, huh? You know, a person becomes an expert when he has spent so much time at something that he becomes an authority. And people flock around authority. Now, let us say for a moment we lived a long time ago and nobody had paid any attention to the Buddha. He had no monks. And the people didn't follow him by droves. Nothing. Nobody paid any attention to him. Do you think he would be considered as an authority? We're very strange. In India, in a little town, there is a bakery. And in this bakery, there is a sign. And this sign reads, "Eat here, a million flies can't be wrong." authority. There are a lot of people who think that the Americans are upstarts, and we may well be. But the reason that they give is not correct. America is only a couple of hundred years old, they say, so of course we're upstarts. Other cultures are ancient. We're children. If a man is 500 years old, he was going to collect a lot of followers. They're all going to know what it is that he did to live to be 500, huh? It's like this Lama in Tibet. Did you meet him? There's a rumor that he was 1,000 years old. And there was an Englishman that heard about this, and so he traveled from London down to see this Lama. And he couldn't believe his eyes, because here sits this man, and he looked to be about 50. And so he started asking around other people, you know, and finally he got to the Lama's chief disciple. "Is it true that your master is 1,000 years old?" And the disciple looks at him, he says, "Well, I can't answer that because I've only been with him for 300 years. Oh. We look to the old for authority. And yet life is young. Life never ages. Not life. We look around and maybe God is a little bit crazy, you know. By the time a man is old enough to become wise, 90 years old, he has known a great deal, he has experienced a great deal. By that time, you should be a little bit wise, huh? And out you go. And you're replaced with a little child who doesn't know anything. Huh? It would seem from that, that God loves innocence more than knowledge. That innocence, you know, Jesus spoke of it. Except ye become a little child, ye shall not enter the kingdom. That innocence of consciousness. Krishna was never old. Of course, we're not sure whether he lived or not, but they say he lived to be about 80. The pictures of him are certainly not of an 80-year-old man toddling around with a staff. No, he's young, playing his flute. Being like a Pied Piper, Religion within you is very fresh. It is like an innocent babe. You know, fresh like the morning dew, like the first star at night, is something, God is always young, although he is called the Ancient of Days. The Ancient of Days is a babe. You know, in the hallway in my house, I've got this crazy picture. There's the ancient, and in the center of it, out comes this baby. This innocence of the Ancient of Days. Yeah. Anyway, the Duke replied to this wheelwright, "What do you know about it? You know, you're only a wheelwright." And the wheelwright said, "Well, let us take a look at the affair from my point of view. When I make wheels, if I go easy, they fall apart. And if I am too rough, they don't fit. But if I am neither too easy nor too violent, they come out right. The work is what I want it to be." You can't put this into words. You have to know how it is. So, extremes, never built a correct wheel. It builds a wobbly wheel, you know. Just to remain in the middle. To remain in the middle between the extremes. How can anyone tell you how to remain in the middle? Well, we could ask a tightrope walker. Yeah, how does he do it? You know, what can he say? If I lean a little too much to the right, then I have to balance by leaning to the left. If I lean too much to the left, then I have to balance by leaning to the right. It can be said, it can be written, but if you ever read anything like that, please don't go out and throw a rope between two mountains and go for a walk. It is not a question of thinking it out. It is a question of feeling. With your whole body, with your whole being, feeling your way. How much to lean? You know, there isn't any fixed formula. It depends on the person. You know, the weight, the height, the wind, and the interstate. The ability to concentrate. If you're going to walk a rope. And Zarathustra did. Life is movement. Life is freshness. And it doesn't repeat itself. It may appear to, but it doesn't. The cloud that you saw this morning is not going to be here tomorrow morning. Not the same cloud. The sun that rose this morning, even though we didn't see it, is in a way not quite the same sun tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning, the whole universe will be different. And it is so vast. And everything is changing, changing, changing. So it said that there is nothing old except the past that we drag around in our minds. That in there is really the only museum in the world. Collection of fossils. It's a graveyard. It's the content of your mind. Otherwise, everything is new. Don't let all that out of your mind, though. You need it. The earth changes, mountains change, rivers change, oceans change, continents change. Africa was once joined with India. Will be again someday, 14,000 years from now. Ceylon at one time was very close to India. After all, the monkey Hanuman, you know, jumped across the stream. You know the monkey Hanuman? No. He was the little monkey that befriended Rama, you know, in defeating Ravana, who had carried off Sita. Sita was Rama's wife. Ravana had captured her and run off. And the audacity and the wit of this monkey, who was supposed to be the son of Vayu, you know, Vayu was the god of wind. Yeah. And the whole thing is described in his epic poem, Ramayana. You know. And so they have in southern India monkey worship and a monkey chant. And if somebody remind me, I've got a copy of the monkey chant on a record. You might like to hear it. It's quite interesting. It is reported that Eddington said, you know, the scientist, that there is one word in our language that is very incorrect. And that word is rest. There is no rest. Everything is moving, 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 and changing. And here this wheelwright is saying he can't even teach his own son, who is so near to him. And now at 70, he is still making wheels, and the body is standing there in tatters. What to do? What to do? You know, the Sufis, they teach through craft. So, of course, then Gurdjieff did also. You learn to be a carpenter, you learn to be a wheelwright, you learn to be a shoemaker. Shaka Brahma was a shoemaker, and he had his experience through that, making shoes. So you learn a craft. And in Zen, usually from a Roshi, a Zen master, you learn a craft such as arranging flowers or serving tea, or Herigoldern learned the art of archery. When you learn the craft, then they're ready to teach you the inner. 10 years, 12 years, 20 years maybe even, learning to make shoes. Then finally the master says, okay. The subject, you know, what you're making, you know, is not the question. It is how you learn. You learn how to learn. And then the keys are presented. Learning how to learn, you sit for meditation. It opens your mind. And then it blows your mind. Yeah, right? See, we cannot, any of us, stand on Buddha's shoulders or Krishna's shoulders or Jesus' shoulders or Muhammad's shoulders, Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu. You can't stand on their shoulders. You have to stand on your own feet, and you have to stand again and again and again on your own feet. Discovering God, let us say, use that word, discovering God within you is always an individual experience. You're not going to go on any excursion. It is an individual experience. What you put into it. The path has been found by many, many, many people throughout the ages, But you have to find it again. You have to find it for you. It's almost as if it were an eternal hide-and-seek game. It's somebody discovers God and God goes into hiding. You have to discover. A lot of people have discovered him. Nobody has ever put up a sign and said, this is where God lives. Finished. No. He's found, and again he's in hiding, and he is a very skillful player. Yeah. You must find him for yourself within the cave of yourself. And it can be done. Others have done it. So don't leave it with just a theory. Take your doubts and jump. Yeah. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.